than Marguerite giving up her child. No matter how much she and Umberto had loved each other, it was the absence of her daughter that had colored Marguerite's life and explained the tragic look in her eyes in some of the photographs. And all the jewelry she had saved for her for so many years was going to auction now, into the hands of strangers, instead of to Marguerite's child. It was one of those terrible injustices and ironies of life. Chapter 13. Philip took the Air France flight to Paris that left New York just before midnight, and was scheduled to arrive at Charles de Gaulle by noon, local time. It would give him a late start to his day by the time he arrived in the city, probably around 2. After he got his luggage, went through immigration, and caught a cab for the hour's drive into town. But he would still have time for several appointments before the end of the working day. He preferred the night flight, where he could sleep on the plane for 5 or 6 hours and arrive in good shape. It was the one he always took when Christie's sent him to Paris once or twice a year or more for important sales there. The plane took off on time, and he ate a quick snack of cheese and fruit and skipped the rest of the meal, although the food was always good. Other passengers preferred getting all the perks they were offered, but a serious meal after midnight was less appealing to him than sleep. And he settled down under a blanket with a pillow an hour after they took off. The pilot had said the flight would take 6.5 hours, half an hour longer than usual, due to heavy winds. Philip was asleep before the plane set out over the Atlantic north of Boston. He slept soundly until the announcement that they were beginning their descent toward Charles de Gaulle Airport in Roissy, and would land in 30 minutes. He had just enough time for a cup of coffee and a croissant, and to brush his teeth, comb his hair, and shave before they arrived, and was back in his seat looking presentable and rested in time to land. It was gray and rainy, and he didn't mind. He loved coming to Paris, whether for jewelry or art, and he was planning to visit some of his old pals from the art department when he went to London after the Paris sale. But he had work to do in Paris in the meantime. He caught a cab easily after he cleared immigration, and told the driver in halting French to take him to the Four Seasons on the Avenue Georges Sank. Christie's always paid for comfortable accommodations, and after walking past the spectacular flowers in the lobby, the room he was given was pleasant and pretty. He showered, and was at the Christie's office on the Avenue Matignon just after 3 o'clock. The magnificent jewel sale, including Marie Antoinette's historic jewelry, was scheduled for the following night, and his Paris counterpart, Gilles de Marigny, roughly the same age as Philip, said that interest in the sale was high, and they had a lot of telephone bids on their books already, and every important museum in Europe had come to see the royal jewels and would be bidding on them. They talked business for a little while, and about politics at the Mother House in New York, and then Philip went to the exhibition rooms to see the lots on display. It was a very impressive sale, and made him think of Marguerite's jewels again. He didn't have time to call the archives department at Cartier until 6 o'clock. They were happy to report to him that they had made good progress on his inquiry, and had found the records of the 8 pieces he had asked about, and working drawings for many of them, except those that had been purchased at the store and had not been made to order for her. They said they would be happy to show him the files and working drawings the next day, which was the day of the Christie's sale, when he knew he couldn't get away, so he made an appointment for the day after. He was looking very pleased when he got off the phone. He then placed a call to Van Cleef and Arpels, but the person he hoped to see, who was in charge of their archives, was out of the country and not expected to return for 2 weeks. But they promised to send him copies of everything they found in their records about the pieces Umberto had bought from them. Details of the provenance, and even working drawings that Christie's could include in the catalog, would be very beneficial to the sale, especially for serious jewelry collectors who wanted to know everything possible in an item's history, both about the person who owned them and about the creation of the piece.
"Good news?"
Gilles asked him as he walked into the office Philip was using for his brief stay.
"I think so. We just got a very interesting estate sale from the court in New York, an abandoned safe deposit box in a bank, which contained a fortune in magnificent jewelry given to its owner while she was married to an Italian count. Some beautiful pieces. Cartier has most of the drawings in their archives. 8 of the items were purchased from them in the 40s and 50s. There are 22 lots in all. We're putting them in the May sale."
"Sounds like a good one,"
Gilles said pleasantly.
He had a pretty young wife and three children, whom Philip had met on earlier trips to Paris, but they had no time to socialize on this trip, right before such an important sale.
"I hope it will be," Philip said about the Pignelli sale,
and then they looked over the bids for the next day that clients had placed as absentee buyers, and there would be many more on the phone and in the room. The sale was expected to bring in millions of euros and important buyers from all over the world. Philip left the Christie's office at 8 and walked back toward the hotel, then decided to keep on walking for a while. The Eiffel Tower was lit up, and there was a hint of spring in the air. He sat down at a small, busy bistro and ordered a glass of wine and a light meal, and got back to the hotel at 10 o'clock after watching the people and enjoying the atmosphere of Paris. He always loved it here. It was the most beautiful city in the world. He watched the news on CNN in his hotel room, read the faxes that had been sent to him by his office after Paris office hours, and checked his messages in New York. It was only 4:30 there, not too late to return calls or do business if he needed to, but he had nothing important to tend to, and by 11 o'clock he was sound asleep, and woke up at 7 the next morning, not sure where he was for a minute. And then he remembered that he was in Paris, and it was the day of the sale. He ordered room service for breakfast, read the International Herald Tribune and the New York Times, and walked to the Christie's office, and arrived just before 10 o'clock. It was a busy day after that. He and Gilles ate sandwiches at his desk, going over final details just before the sale, and were in the auction room before 7, when the sale was scheduled to begin. A well-known auctioneer would be presiding, with several jewelry experts associated with the sale to verify the pieces. And there was a bank of a dozen telephones on one side of the room, at a long table. The men and women at the phones were already calling some of the more important bidders to verify that the lines were good, and that the phone numbers they had for them were the right ones. Gilles and Philip took their places at the back of the room to watch the bidding, and after an announcement of one correction in the catalog and two lots that had been withdrawn, the auction began on time. Marie Antoinette's historical items were scheduled for later in the sale, to create anticipation, but the opening bids were strong. The first three items went for 3 times the estimate, which wasn't uncommon on an important sale with a high degree of interest. And half an hour later, an antique diamond necklace went for 10 times the high estimate and caused a ripple in the room after 2 clients on the phone waged a bidding war against each other, with excellent results both for the seller and for Christie's. The hammer price was just under $1 million. Gilles and Philip exchanged a glance of satisfaction. It was going to be a great sale. And when Marie Antoinette's pieces finally came up, well into the sale, they went for roughly what the house had expected. 2 were purchased by private collectors, as Gilles whispered to Philip. 5 others were purchased by museums, and the best piece had been saved for last, an elegant diamond tiara she was said to have worn at court as a young girl when she was first queen. It sold for 2.5 million euros, just over $3 million, and was sold to the Tate Gallery in London. And the bidding ended with a surprise, which Gilles was familiar with, and Philip had heard about, but had never actually seen happen. The instant the hammer fell, a small bearded man in a brown suit stood up in the 3rd row and declared in a firm voice that carried throughout the room,
"I claim this item for the Museums of France by the power vested in me by the government."
There was dead silence in the room as the uninitiated tried to figure out what had just happened, but Philip already knew the procedure. When an item was historically important, a government representative was sent to the sale, waited for the bidding to end and the hammer to fall, to establish its current market value, and then claimed it for the government of France, and the successful bidder would lose the item, in this case to the Louvre. It was always a great source of disappointment to a successful bidder to lose the desired lot at the last minute, but it was a risk, and Christie's had warned their important clients of the possibility before the sale. The government representative had let the other items go to public sale, but not the tiara. A portrait of the young queen wearing it was already in the Louvre, of which Christie's had been aware. The auction continued after that, and it added even more excitement and drama in the room. Each of the lots sold, some at staggering prices, and when it was all over at 10 o'clock, people claimed their items or made arrangements to have them sent. Many of the lots had been purchased by well-known jewelers in London and New York, and one of the highest bids had been made by a private buyer in Hong Kong.
It was one of those nights when Philip had no regrets about not being in the art department. It had been a terrific sale, and a thrill to be part of it, particularly when the tiara was claimed by the museums of France, although neither he nor Gilles was surprised.
"Good one," he said to Gilles when they left the auction room after it cleared.
It had been one of the most successful sales they had had in years, although the lots had been consigned by many people, not just one famous person, whose whole collection was sold, such as the Elizabeth Taylor sale. Their single-owner sales, particularly of famous people, were usually the more important ones, but sometimes those from a variety of provenances did equally well, as this one had. Philip was still revved up about it when he got back to the hotel, and for lack of someone else to tell, he called his mother about it, but she was out. She was so busy with the many things she did and was interested in, the art classes she still took, boards she served on, and friends she went out with, that she was hard to get hold of at times. He thought of trying to reach Jane after he left his mother a message on her voicemail, but he felt a little foolish calling Jane about it. He didn't know her that well, and she would either be at work or on her way home by then, so he let it go. The next day was exciting for him. After helping Gilles with some of the paperwork and arrangements resulting from the auction the night before, which were considerable, he went to his appointment at Cartier at 11 on the Rue de la Paix and met with the head of the archives department. He was waiting for Philip with a folder on his desk. He had the inventory of items Philip had sent him and went down the list chronologically, rather than in the order Philip had listed them, having no idea when the pieces were created. He was an older man who was intensely knowledgeable about the pieces Cartier had made for important clients, what period of their work they represented, how they differed from other pieces they had designed, and whatever was unusual about them. And he loved sharing the information and showing their working drawings to those who were interested. He was deeply proud of their work. He had worked for Cartier for 30 years. He explained to Philip that the 30-carat emerald cut, meaning rectangular, the style of cut referred to any color stone, not just an emerald, which Philip knew, of course, after 2 years in the jewelry department at Christie's, although he hadn't known it before. Emerald ring with triangular emerald trillions of 4 carats each on either side was the first piece the Conte di San Pignelli had commissioned from them, and the notes on the exquisite and immaculately neat working drawings indicated that it was a wedding present for his bride. He ordered it in late 1942, and the ring took 6 months to complete. It was a magnificent piece, Philip knew from having seen it in New York. Umberto had bought the pearl and diamond choker for her a year later, for her birthday, and the measurements of Marguerite's neck were duly noted on the worksheets.
"She had a very long, thin, aristocratic neck, like a swan," the archivist from Cartier said with a smile.
They had a photograph in the file of her wearing the choker sometime later, which Philip wanted to reproduce for the catalog with their permission, with a credit to Cartier's archives listed beneath it. Marguerite was smiling in the photograph, wearing a white satin evening gown, and looked exquisite on her husband's arm.
"We also sold him the very important pearl necklace on your list, which was an item we apparently had in the store, and we did not make it for her. They were natural pearls, which are even rarer now."
Philip remembered it perfectly from the inventory. The pearls in the long strand were of an unusual size and a smooth, creamy color, unblemished and flawless.
"We sold that to the Count a year after the choker, at almost the same time, so it must have been a birthday gift as well."
There was a very handsome diamond brooch that was noted as an anniversary gift after the war, and one of their famous tiger bracelets in white diamonds and onyx that was also for an anniversary. The 25-carat oval pigeon's blood Burmese ruby ring was for their 5th anniversary and had taken a year to make, according to the notes in the file.
"Probably to find a stone which was unusually large for a Burmese ruby of that color."
The 40-carat white diamond emerald-cut ring had been his 10th anniversary gift to her, and he had purchased the large yellow diamond ring for her to mark their 20th anniversary in 1962, 3 years before he died.
"She had some of our best, most memorable pieces. We wonder where they are sometimes, and then they surface, and we become aware of them when heirs put them up for auction, or in situations like this one. I imagine it will make a very handsome sale,
the Cartier archivist said.
Would you like me to send you a copy of our files, the drawings and the occasions?
It was precisely what Philip wanted, and he had struck gold at Cartier. The information they provided would give even greater meaning and value to the pieces, and be valuable to the people who bought them, whether jewelers for resale or privates who would want to know everything about their origins and who had owned them.
The Count was a very generous man, Philip commented before he left.
He must have loved her very much,
the man from Cartier said discreetly. He himself was enamored with the history of their pieces and had dedicated most of his career to their archives and adding information about the new creations. It was his life's work. Philip thanked him for his time and the excellent research, told him where to email the drawings for the catalog, and then they shook hands and said goodbye, and he left. Philip stopped for lunch at a sidewalk cafe, thinking about what he'd learned at Cartier, and then went to Van Cleef and Arpels, even though the head of the archives department was away. His visit there was briefer, but also instructive. The number two person in the department was able to tell him that the invisibly set sapphire necklace and earrings, in a typical style from the 1940s, had been a birthday gift. A simple diamond pin had been a Christmas gift, and a sapphire ring and bracelet had been a Christmas gift as well. The stones in the Van Cleef pieces weren't as large, but the settings were remarkable, the quality exceptional, and the pieces really lovely. He hadn't contacted Boucheron about some of Marguerite's less important pieces. Umberto seemed to have a strong preference for Van Cleef and Cartier, and she had jewelry from a few other Paris jewelers that no longer existed. Christie's own in-house jewelry experts had determined that Marguerite's small diamond tiara was an antique, and thus impossible to trace. They were certain it was French, but said it might have been purchased in London. The remainder of her jewelry had been made in Italy, notably two pieces by Bulgari, whom Philip hadn't had time to contact yet. But his trip to Paris had been fruitful. He had a wealth of information about Marguerite's jewelry now, even their original prices, which bore little relation to their value now. The prices had been astronomical when they were purchased, but more than 70 years later, the price of jewelry and gemstones had multiplied exponentially, and stones of the caliber of her jewelry were almost impossible to find in the modern world. Philip went back to the Christie's office after his appointment at Van Cleef, and he had nothing more to do. He had been sent to the Paris sale as an observer and to lend a hand, but his work was over, and the Paris office could manage the rest. He was taking the Eurostar to London that night, mostly to show his face and check in at their London office, as long as he was in Paris anyway. And he always liked going to London and seeing his friends in the art department. He said goodbye to Gilles, who wished him luck with the May sale. He stayed at Claridge's in London and took a walk down New Bond Street, where he admired the wares of Graff and the other important jewelers. They sold a lot of Graff pieces at auction, with flawless stones and beautiful designs, which were known to go for high prices, and Lorenz Graff purchased stones from them as well to incorporate in his designs. He was known to buy incredibly valuable stones in rare colors like pink and blue diamonds in the largest sizes he could find. He had become the modern-day Harry Winston, with remarkable pieces at extraordinary prices. Philip enjoyed looking in Graff's windows on his walk. Despite Philip's preference for art over jewelry, Graff's pieces were best in show, and he admired him for that. And on the way back to the hotel, he looked into several art galleries as well. And the next morning, he went to the Christie's office and met with his British counterparts there and discussed their upcoming sales. It was nice to see them and have a serious conversation, and not just exchange impersonal emails with them, and he advised them in greater detail about the May sale in New York. They were interested in hearing about the Di San Pignelli estate, how it had come to them through the surrogate's court and his recent discoveries about the pieces at Cartier and Van Cleef. And when he went to pack late that afternoon, he decided, on the spur of the moment, to go to Rome after all, to complete his research, and had the concierge book him a flight at 9 p.m. It was an easy hop from London, and they reserved a room for him at the Hostler. He wasn't planning to stay long. He only wanted to see the jewelers there. There were only one or two he planned to visit the next day. After a brief delay at Heathrow, he arrived at the hotel in Rome just after midnight. His room was not large, but comfortable, with a small balcony and decorated in lush yellow satin and antiques, and had a beautiful view of Rome. The city was alive and bustling at that hour, with all the chaos and electricity he loved about it, and people in the streets. He poured himself a short brandy and stood drinking it on the terrace, admiring the view under a full moon. As beautiful as Paris was, he always thought that Rome was the most romantic city in the world, and it depressed him a little to be standing there alone. It made him think that his mother was right, and he should be making more of an effort to meet someone, and do more than spend every weekend working on his boat. It would have been nice to have company in Rome with him, although he had come for business. He slept soundly after the brandy, on a canopied bed, and woke up at 8 the next morning. He had a strong Italian espresso, and was at Bulgari on Via Condotti when they opened at 10 o'clock. Both the emerald and diamond bracelet and the lacy diamond bracelet in Marguerite's safe deposit box were from there, but with regret they told him that they no longer had records that went back that far. Many of their older records were destroyed in the war. It had been a long shot coming to see them, and a good excuse to go to Rome as long as he was in Europe for the Paris sale. He wandered along the Via Condotti after that, and stopped in at Prada to buy a shirt, and by 1 o'clock, when many of the stores closed for lunch, he had finished his business there. He went to a trattoria for a plate of pasta and a glass of wine, and as he watched the lively scene around him, another thought came to mind. He really didn't need it as research for the catalogue, but he suddenly felt an irresistible pull to go to Naples to see the chateau the Pignellis had lived in there. There was a Roman address on some of her papers, too, and he had the cab driver pass it on the way back to the hotel. It was a handsome but innocuous building, where they must have had a Roman pied-à-terre. But her main address for 32 years had been in Naples, which he assumed had been the Count's principal residence and family seat. He was aching to see it now. He didn't have a heavy schedule when he went back to New York, and was tempted to add one more day to his trip for the detour to Naples, and inquired about flights when he got back to the hotel at 2:30. The concierge told him there was one from Fiumicino Airport to Naples at 6 o'clock, which he could easily catch, and they offered to book a room for him at the Grand Hotel Vesuvio, which they assured him was very agreeable. And feeling as though he were taking a leap into space, he asked them to make the reservations for him for both hotel and flight. His mission to discover more about Marguerite Pierson di San Pignelli was beginning to take over his life, and he was faintly embarrassed by his obsession with her. But it was irresistible. An hour later, he was in a cab on the way to the airport, headed for Naples, with no concrete idea of what he hoped to discover there. All he knew was that he felt compelled to go. Something was beckoning to him, and he wasn't sure what it was. He wished he could talk to Jane, and wondered if she'd understand, or think he was insane. Neither of them had a tie to this woman, and yet she had snagged their hearts. The flight landed at Naples International Airport in Capo Dicino, and Philip took a cab to the hotel and checked in. His room had a balcony and a spectacular view of the Bay of Naples. It was a city he felt less comfortable walking around in, and it had a dicey reputation for street crimes, mostly by pickpockets, so he had dinner at the excellent Caruso restaurant on the 9th floor. And he arranged to rent a car for the next day, which was delivered to the hotel. It was a serviceable, no-frills Fiat sedan, and he had gotten careful directions from the concierge about how to reach Marguerite's address, which he assumed was the chateau. The concierge had told him it was at the very edge of the city, in a beautiful location, although a bit out of the way. And as he drove there, Philip could see Mount Vesuvius in the distance, and he thought about Pompeii. He had gone there with his parents as a boy, and had been fascinated by it. Not only the relics and artifacts, but the people who had been covered with lava and killed instantly and mummified just as they had been that day, engaged in their ordinary activities. He remembered it vividly still, and it had made a deep impression on him as a child. He had wanted to know if there were volcanoes in New York, and was relieved to hear there weren't. The memory made him smile. It took him a good half hour to reach the edge of the city in Neapolitan traffic, where people drove even more erratically than they did in Rome. And he was glancing at the directions when he turned a corner and suddenly saw it, a beautiful small chateau. It was an elegant structure with a tall wall around it and enormous old trees inside the walls. There was a large double gate, and he could see a cobbled courtyard inside. He checked the address he had written down and saw that he'd arrived. He parked the car and got out to look around. He hesitated at the open gate and saw two gardeners and a man in casual clothes directing them and pointing at the gardens as they nodded. He was a tall man who looked to be in his 60s with a thick head of white hair, and he turned to glance at Philip with a quizzical expression and then walked toward him when he finished with the gardeners. Philip didn't know what to say, and his Italian wasn't adequate to explain why he was there.
"Posso aiutarla?"
the man asked clearly in a deep, sonorous voice. His face was lined, but his eyes were lively, and he looked nothing like the Count in the photographs, who had long, lean, aristocratic features and was very thin and tall. This man appeared as though he enjoyed a good meal and a good laugh. His eyes were friendly but questioning as he gazed at Philip, having asked what he could do to help him.
"Do you speak English?"
Philip asked him cautiously, not sure what he'd do if he didn't. His motive in being there was too complicated to explain in sign language, and was sketchy at best. He really didn't need to be there. He had just wanted to come, out of curiosity about Marguerite.
"Small,"
the man answered, holding up two fingers to indicate very little, as he smiled.
"I wanted to see the chateau,"
Philip explained slowly, feeling slightly foolish.
"I know someone who lived here a long time ago."
That was a stretch, too, since he really hadn't known her, but only about her. The man nodded that he understood.
"A parent, grandmother?"
he asked. Philip didn't know that the word for parent and relative in Italian was the same, but he got the idea and shook his head, and he could hardly say, "No, a woman whose jewelry we'll be selling at Christie's, whom I never met but am fascinated by," which was the case. And then he suddenly remembered the copies of the photographs of her he had in his computer case in the car, and went to get them, indicating to the man to wait, which he did patiently. Philip returned with them a moment later, and showed him the photographs of Umberto and Marguerite in front of the chateau, with the gardens and some of the stables, which Philip guessed must have been behind the chateau, or maybe didn't exist anymore. And when he saw the photographs, the older man's face lit up immediately, and he nodded enthusiastically.
"Umberto and Marguerite di San Pignelli,"
Philip said, pointing at them, and the man nodded again.
"Il Conte e la Contessa,"
he said their titles, and Philip nodded and smiled.
"Are you of the same family?"
Philip asked him, and the man shook his head.
"No, I buy 10 years ago,"
he said clearly.
"He die a long time ago. No family, no children. He die, she sold a house, go to Rome. Other people buy, make house very broken, then sell to me. They have no money, so they sell me."
His English was broken, but he had no problem conveying to Philip what had happened. Marguerite had sold the house after her husband's death, moved to Rome, and the people she sold it to had run it into the ground for lack of money, and then sold it to him. And he seemed to be taking good care of the place, and the Ferrari and Lamborghini that Philip could see in the courtyard indicated that he had the money to do it.
"Il conte era molto elegante, e lei bellissima,"
he said, talking about how elegant Umberto was and how beautiful Marguerite had been, as he looked through the photographs.
"Very sad, no children for house," he said.
He would have liked to know more about Philip's interest in the place, but didn't have a sufficient grasp of English to ask him about it. Nonetheless, he beckoned Philip to come inside and look around, and feeling grateful for the warm reception, he followed the new owner into the house. And once within the walls of the chateau, Philip found himself walking through beautiful rooms with handsome antiques and wonderful modern art that married well in the decor. The walls were painted soft, subtle pastel colors, and from the upper floors, where he took Philip on a tour, he had a spectacular view of the sea.
"I love very much this house,"
the man explained, touching his heart as Philip nodded.
"Good feeling, very warm. It belonged to Il Conte's family 400 years. I am from Firenze, but now Napoli too. Sometimes Roma. Galleria d'arte,"
he said, pointing at the paintings and then at himself, and Philip assumed he meant that he was an art dealer, and the paintings on the walls were impressive, by well-known artists whom Philip easily recognized. He took out his business card then, showing him as a vice president of Christie's, which the owner of the chateau recognized immediately and was visibly impressed.
"Gioielli," he said, pointing to the word jewelry on Philip's card,
and he nodded.
"Before, prima."
Philip used one of the few Italian words he knew.
"Art, paintings."
He pointed at the art on the walls.
"Now, adesso, gioielli, but I prefer art."
The man laughed as he understood, and seemed to agree, and then referred to Umberto and Marguerite again.
"La Contessa aveva gioielli fantastici,"
he said, pointing to the photographs of Marguerite and some of her jewels.
"I hear this. Very famous jewels, but then no money when Il Conte died. Many cars, horses, gioielli, so she sell house, and maybe very sad here after he die, especially with no children."
Philip nodded agreement. The owner of the chateau was creating a vision, even with few words, of a couple who had spent a great deal of money, and perhaps begun to run out of it at the time of Umberto's death, so she had sold the chateau and moved to an apartment in the building he'd driven past in Rome. She had probably lived on the proceeds from the chateau for quite some time, and then gone back to the States. From all Philip had gleaned so far, from the small apartment where she had lived in Murray Hill and the nursing home in Queens, she had lived simply in New York. Her days of glory had been here, while Umberto was still alive. After he died, all that was left was the value of the jewels, which was considerable. But she had never sold the jewelry for money to live on, perhaps out of love for him, with the exception of two rings. It had obviously been a powerful love story, the memory of which had endured for the rest of her life, and long after his. Thinking the same thing, the Italian pointed to the pictures of them and touched his heart with a tender look, and Philip nodded. That was precisely what had brought him here, and the man he was conversing with, however awkwardly, seemed to understand. He took his own business card out to give Philip then, and he had guessed right. His name was Saverio Salvatore, and he owned an art gallery of the same name, with addresses in both Florence and Rome. It had been a fortuitous meeting, and Philip enjoyed talking to him. As they walked back to the courtyard, and Philip thanked him in both Italian and English, Saverio looked at Philip warmly and pointed to a particularly endearing photograph of Marguerite and Umberto.
"You send to me? I like for this house. It was their home for many years."
Philip agreed to immediately and said he would send him several. It touched him that the new owner wanted to have their photographs. Their love story endeared them to everyone. The two men shook hands before Philip walked out of the gate, and Saverio waved and wandered back into the house. They hadn't toured the grounds, which were extensive, but Philip had seen enough. He had gotten a strong sense of what their home had been like, and how and where they'd lived. It was a very grand life, and it gave him a warm feeling that the man who was living there cared about and respected them. Their memories were not forgotten. And Philip felt a feeling of peace wash over him as he started the car and drove back to the hotel. The trip to Naples had served no useful function for Christie's or the sale of Marguerite's things, and yet he knew that in coming here he had done the right thing. He was certain of it, and he was going to keep Saverio's card and hope they'd meet again. He had every intention of fulfilling his promise and sending him the photographs of Umberto and Marguerite.
Chapter 14.
Philip called his mother that weekend when he was back in New York. He wanted to have dinner with her on Sunday night and tell her all he had learned about Marguerite, her jewelry, and that he had even seen the house where they had lived. He knew that she'd be interested, and it gave more substance to the story now. Marguerite was no longer a complete mystery to them. She had been a woman with a home, a man who had loved her, and a favored life. She was not just a name on a safe deposit box at the bank, who had owned a collection of extremely valuable jewels. Knowing now that she was running out of money, was down to $2,000 when she died, lived in a tiny apartment for many years, had ended her days in a seedy nursing home in Queens, and hadn't sold the jewels to live more comfortably, was even more touching and intriguing. The jewelry from Umberto had obviously meant a great deal to her. He wanted to say all that to his mother, and tell her all about the auction in Paris and the rest of his trip, including the dramatic moment when Marie Antoinette's tiara had been claimed by the government for the French museums. He knew she would love hearing about that, and he was surprised to hear her sounding somewhat somber when he called, or serious, and she said she wanted to see him, too. She seemed as though she had something to say.
"Are you okay, Mom? Is something wrong?"
"No, I just want to talk. I have some decisions to make."
"Is it your health?" he said, with a feeling of panic.
"No, darling, I'm fine. Just some other stuff. I want your excellent advice."
He knew that she sold some of his father's stock certificates from time to time. She was invested in a solid fund where she didn't have to worry about the insurance money she had inherited when his father died, and she liked asking Philip's advice.
"Sunday night?"
"That's fine. Have a nice weekend."
But he was concerned about her after they talked. She gave him the impression that she had a serious matter on her mind, and he hoped she wasn't lying to him, and that her health really was all right. As an only child, he felt responsible for her and worried about her, no matter how youthful and independent she was. She was still 74 years old, even if she didn't look it or act it. He thought about Jane Willoughby again that weekend, too. He wanted to call her and tell her about the results of his trip and his research about Marguerite, and he decided to invite her to lunch again, boyfriend or not. He had learned a lot about Marguerite in Europe and wanted to share it with her. While he worked on his boat, Jane was moving into her new apartment. It was a small one-bedroom in the meatpacking district near Alex, and she was delighted with it. Her parents were going to help her pay the rent until she got a job. Jane hadn't heard a word from John since she had moved out. The waters had closed over her without a trace. It was as though he had forgotten she'd existed, which was hurtful at best. And she assumed he was with Kara and didn't care. It was a tough lesson for Jane, and she was sorry she hadn't moved when things started to go sour months before. The last 6 months had been a total waste of time, and his blithe ignoring her, with the excuse of school and projects, had been insulting. Jane had taken a day off from work that week and gone to IKEA to buy the basics she needed since she had no furniture, and Alex helped her put it together. She was good with a screwdriver and a hammer, and by Sunday night Jane was moved in, and the place looked great. It gave her a new lease on life. She and Alex ate popcorn and watched a movie that night to initiate her new home. Philip left Long Island on Sunday afternoon a little earlier than usual. It was raining, he knew there would be traffic, and he was anxious to see his mother. He stopped and bought a bottle of rosé wine he knew she liked, and at 5 o'clock he rang her doorbell, and she looked surprised to see him.
"You're early,"
she said with pleasure as he handed her the wine, which pleased her too. "It sounds like we have a lot to talk about, so I thought I'd give us some more time," he said easily as he walked into the apartment. He could tell she'd been working. He could smell the fresh oil paints, a familiar scent he loved and always associated with his mother, and had all his life. She poured them each a glass of wine a few minutes later, and they sat down in the cozy living room. She was in her favorite old leather armchair, and he on the couch, as he looked at her quizzically.
"So, what's up? You first." He'd been worried about her for 2 days.
"It's kind of a long story," she said with a sigh, and took a sip of the wine. "I knew about it the last time I saw you, but I needed some time to think about it. It came as kind of a shock."
He was more sure than ever, as he listened to her, that she had a health problem, and he nearly held his breath as he listened. But in spite of what she was saying, she looked healthy to him, and no different than before.
"I told you that I went to see Fiona, my old nanny. I wanted her to help me make sense of something. When I looked at the photographs you gave me of Marguerite, nothing earth-shattering struck me about her. I guess I could see some vague family resemblance, but all she had were American Anglo-Saxon good looks, and let's face it, all WASPs look the same," she said dismissively, and he laughed at his mother's typical irreverence.
"Well, not always," he responded, and she smiled.
"I didn't see anything remarkable about her in terms of looks, but what rocked me to the core were the photographs of the little girl. There aren't a lot of photographs of me as a child, as I didn't have doting parents, to say the least. But when I looked at those pictures, I was certain that they were me. There is no name written on any of them, but I was the same age as that child on those dates, and in a couple of them I was absolutely sure. What I couldn't understand was why my photos were in the safe deposit box. What were they doing there? I went to see Winnie about it, and I had a strange idea. I was suddenly suspicious of the fact that there were no photographs of my older sister, Marguerite. Supposedly, my mother was so devastated by her death that she destroyed them all, and any physical evidence of her, which always seemed odd to me. Wouldn't she have carefully preserved every shred of memories of her lost daughter? Your grandparents were unbearably uptight, cold, judgmental people, and I suddenly began wondering, what if Marguerite didn't die? What if she had fallen in love with an Italian count, of which they would have strongly disapproved, I'm sure? And what if they only said she died, and she had been alive and living with an Italian husband for all those years? What if it was not a coincidence of name, and Marguerite di San Pignelli was in fact my oldest sister? They are the same age, and I don't know why, but I suddenly became overwhelmingly convinced that might be the case. Winnie was only 4 when she left, and I was a baby, but I wondered if she'd ever suspected Marguerite was alive, or heard something that made her question what we'd been told.
Valerie looked at her son intently. And what did she say? He was intrigued by what she said.
That I was senile, that I'm insane, that our parents would never do a thing like that. She liked them a lot better than I did, and they were nicer to her. More important, she was just like them. I never was. So they always tried to pound me into thinking and behaving like them, and I couldn't. She told me what I thought was preposterous. That our parents would never lie to us, and the photographs weren't me, of course, and all children looked and dressed like that at the time, which is partially true. But that child's face was so like me, and my eyes. I got nowhere with Winnie, and we had a huge fight. And that night, it occurred to me to go and see Fiona, and ask her what she knew. I figured she might know more about the circumstances in which my sister left. Years later, we were told that she had gone to study in Europe, in Switzerland, since there was a war on. But why would you let your daughter go there during a war? And if she went to England, why did she die in Italy? We were never allowed to ask questions about her, or even mention her name, and I was always curious about her. So I thought maybe Fiona could tell me something, and she'd recognize the photographs of Marguerite, if it was she, since she came to work for us 2 years before my sister left. So I drove to New Hampshire to see her. She's 94, but clear as a bell.
Valerie seemed breathless as she went on with the story, and Philip listened, with no idea what would come next.
I showed her the photographs and asked her if Marguerite di San Pignelli was my sister, and I was heartbroken when she said no. But I was in no way prepared for what she said next. She told me that Marguerite was my mother. She got pregnant by a boy she loved at 17. He was just shy of 18 at the time. Both sets of parents were outraged and wouldn't let them get married and separated them. Marguerite was sent away to a home for wayward girls in Maine to have the baby in hiding and give it up for adoption. A few weeks after she left the city, the Japanese hit Pearl Harbor. The boy was drafted and sent to boot camp, and then to California for training, and was killed in an accident almost immediately. And apparently Marguerite refused to give up the baby. So her parents, my grandparents, disappeared with her, and returned to New York a few months after the baby was born, pretending the baby was theirs, but obviously hating every minute of it. They put Marguerite on a neutral Swedish ship to Lisbon, from where she went to London. She was never going to Switzerland. And a year later, they said she died of influenza, and got rid of her forever, as far as they were concerned. In actual fact, she met the Count in London when she got there. She was alone at 18 in a foreign country, with a war on. He was kind to her, they married very quickly, and he took her back to Italy with him, to live at his family home in Naples. But her parents had banished their own child, Philip, their firstborn daughter, just to avoid a scandal, she said with a look of outrage and tears in her eyes. They just cut her out of their lives forever and kept her baby, even if they didn't want it and never loved it. Fiona says that Marguerite and the Count tried to get her baby back several years later, and her parents did everything to defeat her and scare her off and threaten her to keep the story quiet. And she eventually gave up. and all Fiona could do was send her photographs of her daughter periodically, until she left us 10 years later. But Philip,
Valerie said, her eyes welling up with tears, which overflowed now.
That baby was me. Marguerite was my mother, not my sister. And my grandparents stole me from her, and pretended to be my parents, and hated me forever because of the disgrace my birth would have meant to them. I've lived a lie all my life, and was robbed of my mother because of them. Marguerite Pearson de Sanpignelli was my mother. I have no idea what to do about it, or who one tells something like that to, or even if it matters at this point. She's dead.
She felt like an orphan again as she said it, just as she had the day she found out.
But there's no question. She was my mother. It is the weirdest of coincidences, even more so than we ever thought it could be, or than I thought when I started to wonder if she was my sister. It was like I was meant to find her when you got called to do that appraisal from Christie's. She was your grandmother, Philip, and the mother I never knew, and should have.
The tears spilled down her cheeks, and Philip put his arms around her and held her. He had never seen his mother as bereft, except when his father died. Valerie cried softly as he held her.
Did you tell Winnie?
He asked her, and she nodded.
This time she believed me. She still made excuses for them and said she's sure they thought they were doing the right thing, but keeping my mother from me all my life, treating me like an unwelcome intruder, banishing their daughter and pretending she was dead could hardly have felt like the right thing, even to them. Winnie begged me not to make a fuss about it, or even say anything. Originally, she accused me of being after the jewelry, but in a way, this is all much more shocking than wanting to be the heir to a fortune in jewelry. It's a hideous lie propagated by my grandparents, and they must have ruined Marguerite's life, having stolen her only child from her. And the poor woman died alone.
Valerie dried her tears and looked deeply moved by it, as Philip thought about what she had just said.
I wasn't thinking about the jewelry, just about what all this meant to your mother and to you. I agree, it's an awful story.
But now there was the jewelry to consider, too.
The truth is, Mom, you are the heir to the jewelry. You're her only child, and if that's true, you should have it.
It belongs to Winnie, too. She was her sister, but I really don't care about the jewelry. It won't bring my mother back now.
No, but she would want you to have it. I think there's a reason why she hung on to it for all these years, even when she had so little money left. Either she kept it out of love for Umberto, or she hoped to find you one day and give it to you.
If that were true, she'd have written a will, and she didn't,
his mother reminded him.
You don't know what she was thinking or what condition she was in the end. The simple fact is that these things belong to her, and you're her only daughter. I'm not sure what we do now, but there's a lot more to the story than meets the eye here, other than your grandparents' terrible behavior. Your mother left a fortune in jewels, and they belong to you.
It was an outcome he had never in his wildest dreams expected, even when he had asked her about the coincidence of maiden names. He had thought Marguerite might be some very distant cousin, but not his maternal grandmother. It was an astounding revelation for all of them, and they couldn't let the story lie where it had fallen. Now they had to do the right thing. Philip didn't know what that was yet, but he wanted to think about it and make the appropriate decision. When he calmed down from the shock of the information his mother had shared with him, he told her about his visits to Cartier and Van Cleef, and what he knew about the jewelry now, and its origins, and the meaningful occasions on which it had been given. And he told her about visiting their home, the chateau, and meeting Saverio Salvatore in Naples, the current owner of the chateau, what a charming man he had been, and the little he had known about Marguerite and Umberto. It all fit together now, a perfect puzzle, with few pieces missing.
"I'd like to see it one day,"
Valerie said wistfully about the home where her mother had lived for 32 years with a stepfather she had never known. Valerie was slowly acquiring a family she never knew she had, who even posthumously seemed more real to her than the parents she'd grown up with. They talked long into the night, eating in the kitchen, and putting all the pieces together as they looked at the photographs again. Valerie admitted to him, as they finished the wine, that she wanted to do a portrait of her mother from the photographs he'd given her. She seemed to want to cling to her now, like the motherless child she had once been, and healed the tragic losses of the past. Philip was deeply moved by all of it when he left and went home that night. There was so much to think about the past, present, and future, and some decision had to be made about the jewelry. And all Philip could think of was that he had to call Jane in the morning. She probably wouldn't know any more than he did about what his mother had to do now, but clearly they had to do something. What remained to be seen? Chapter 15. Philip called Jane the next morning before she had time to take her coat off in her office. He was still at home. "How was your trip?" she asked him, obviously happy to hear from him. She had been thinking about him that morning. "Very interesting," he said, feeling distracted and sounding serious. He had been awake most of the night, thinking of what his mother had told him and what he had to do now to help her. He cut to the chase. "I was wondering if we could have lunch today. I have something I'd like to discuss with you." Given the tone of his voice, it sounded like business, not romance, and she couldn't imagine what it was. "Sure, of course. Where would you like me to meet you?" He suggested another restaurant near his office that wasn't too noisy and had good sandwiches, burgers, and salads. He didn't want to be distracted by fancy food, intrusive waiters, or noisy customers. They agreed to meet at 12:30, and he was already at the table when she got there. He was wearing a blazer and a sweater and gray slacks, and she had dressed casually as well, not expecting to have a lunch date. And she could see from the look in his eyes that he was worried about something. They both ordered club sandwiches and agreed to share a salad, and as soon as the waiter had taken their order, Philip turned to her and told her about his trip to Europe, the visits to Van Cleef and Cartier, and the chateau in Naples. She was touched to hear everything he told her, and then he took a breath and decided to plunge into the deep end and tell her the rest. It was very personal and very moving, but having shared the adventure this far, he thought she ought to know. "Jane, my mother has been doing some sleuthing herself, and some amazing information has turned up. As it turns out, there was more than a coincidence of names here, a lot more." He told her then what Valerie had learned from Fiona and what she had told him the night before, that he hadn't yet fully absorbed. "It seems incredible and stranger yet that you would just happen to call Christie's for this appraisal, and it led to my mother discovering the truth about her birth, her mother, and a whole mystery is unraveled right before our eyes. Fact is definitely stranger than fiction. And weirdest of all, my mother turns out to be Marguerite de Saint-Pignelli's direct heir. And Marguerite is my grandmother. Talk about strange." He looked bowled over as he said it, and Jane was amazed. As she listened to him tell his mother's story, the similarity of what she had gleaned from the letters had struck her, and she was stunned. "I'm not sure what we do now, or how we prove to the court that my mother is Marguerite's rightful heir. She can't just walk into surrogate's court and say, 'Hi, she was my mom.' And since her grandparents faked the birth certificate in some way, claiming her as their own, I don't suppose that will be easy to prove either. Not to mention the fact that the auction is in 2 months. I'm sure it will all fall into place in the end, but I'm not sure what the next step is, and I wanted your advice. What do you think?" She could hardly find words to answer him for a minute, and then instinctively switched into legal gear. There was no doubt in her mind what he had to do. "You need to call a lawyer, and fast. You can't sort this out on your own. You need to advise the surrogate's court that an heir has been located. Your mother needs to come forward officially, and then you'll need to provide proof. How long that will take, what the steps are in the process, or what proof they will require, I don't know. But a lawyer will. This isn't my area of expertise. How is your mother taking this, by the way? It must be a terrible shock to discover that the people she thought of as her parents cheated her out of her real mother and kept them separated from each other all her life. It's really heartbreaking to hear stories like that. I know it happens, but it must be an awful feeling for her," Jane said with compassion in her eyes. Marguerite's poignant story and his mother's had reality for her now and touched her deeply.
She's very upset, and I can't blame her. She really isn't thinking about the jewelry at this point, just about the mother she lost. And I gathered that her grandmother was never nice to her. She was a very cold woman, and I guess she always held against my mother the circumstances of her birth, unfair as that is. But in spite of all that, we have to deal with the jewelry, too. It can't be sold now that there is a rightful heir, without that heir's permission, and my mother will have to be legally acknowledged as the heir first, and I have no idea if that will take days or months. He looked worried about it, and so did Jane.
I don't know either, she admitted. The timing of that could be anything, and courts never move quickly, particularly when they're handling the estates of deceased people who can't complain about how long it's taking.
They both smiled at that. I also don't know if my Aunt Edwina is going to make a claim on the estate. Marguerite was her sister, and she may want a part of it, too.
You need to call an attorney immediately, Jane reiterated. I can get a recommendation if you like, she offered helpfully.
I have someone in mind, he said quietly.
Call them today, she urged him, as he nodded and paid the check, and then thanked her for listening and for her good advice. It helped being able to talk to her, and he appreciated it. She was still awestruck that destiny had led her to call Philip, and that his mother was the child whom Marguerite wrote about in her letters, and had grieved for most of her life. The force of it was overwhelming. When Harriet had me read the letters in the safe deposit box, I was still hoping to find a will. I didn't. They were only letters, but the whole story is there. Everything you just told me, from her mother's side. Leaving the baby she called her darling angel in New York, being forced to disappear, arriving in London during the war, meeting the Count, marrying and living with him, and attempting to get her child back when she was 7. They did what they could, and were stymied by her parents at every turn. She went back to see her when the child was 18, to tell her the whole story, and once she saw her from a distance, she was afraid to disrupt her life and ruin it, and trade her daughter's respectable life for a scandalous one. Then she went back to Italy without seeing her, and eventually just gave up. She wrote letters to her lost daughter for more than 70 years. They were love letters to her child. She never named her, and she always said that she was going to leave the jewelry to her. She was going to write a will, but she obviously never got around to it. And you can tell from her letters that her mind was no longer clear in the end. She was lost in the past. There is nothing in the letters that would provide adequate legal proof, except if your mother can prove that Marguerite is her mother. But it's all there, the whole sad story from beginning to end, and some sweet times, too. She was happy with the Count, but the most powerful force in her life was her missing child. I still have the copies of the letters in the file. I'll scan them for you. It's a sad story, but it will tell your mother how much her mother loved her during all those years they lost and never had as mother and child. She could only guess at how much the letters would mean to Philip's mother. They were her mother's voice speaking to her. Philip looked overwhelmed by what she had just said, and it would be an important testimony to give his mother, to know how her mother had felt.
I'd be very grateful to you if you send me the copies of the letters. They might be tough for my mother to read, but maybe healing in a way, too. All she knows now is from other people. Hearing it in her mother's letters would be an incredible gift.
I'm so happy I read them, Jane said quietly, even if they hadn't yielded a will, which would have been more useful to him.
They went out to the street then, both of them a little dazed by what they'd shared. And to distract them both from the heavy emotions of their discovery, he decided to inquire how things were going with her boyfriend, not expecting anything to have changed.
Actually, she said, smiling up at him once they were on the sidewalk outside, some things happened that changed the situation for me. I moved out. I just moved into my own place in the meatpacking district, and I love it.
Are you still seeing him? Philip asked, hoping she wasn't.
No, I'm not, she said quietly. He was cheating on me, and I just found out. I should have given up 6 months ago when the relationship went sour, but I thought it would work out. It didn't, and he's moving back to L.A. with her.
It had been a total bust, as Philip could deduce, and he hoped it hadn't been too painful for her. She seemed calm and philosophical about it, and even relieved. "Could I invite you for dinner sometime?" he asked her, just as he had before, and this time she nodded and looked pleased.
"I'd like that a lot," she said with a warm smile,
and he promised to keep her informed about his mother's situation and what they would be doing to confirm her as Marguerite's heir. He had a feeling it would be complicated and maybe a lengthy process, and she promised to send him the copies of Marguerite's letters that afternoon. He wanted to copy them and read them himself. He felt enormous compassion for his mother over what she'd just learned.
"I'll call you," he promised, and after kissing her on the cheek, she wished him luck.
He hurried back to his office then to contact his cousin Penny. She was the attorney he had in mind. She worked for a great firm, was a partner herself, and always gave him good advice. He called her as soon as he sat down at his desk, and she walked out of a meeting to talk to him. As cousins and only children, they had always been extremely close. Penny was 45 years old and had three teenage children, a 13-year-old son, a 15-year-old daughter who drove her crazy, and an 18-year-old son who was in his last year of high school. They were the grandchildren Winnie complained about constantly to her sister.
"What's up? Did you get arrested?"
she asked hopefully, and he laughed. "Not yet. I'm still working on it. Listen, something has happened. This is a biggie. Can I come down to your office and see you?" She worked on Wall Street, and her specialty was tax and estate law, so this was right up her alley.
"When were you thinking?"
"Now? Later? In 10 minutes?"
"Shit. I'm in meetings till 6 o'clock. If it's important, I'll ask my housekeeper to stay late and feed the monsters."
"It would be great if you could do that," he said honestly.
"See you at 6 then. You're not in trouble, are you? Tax fraud? Embezzlement?"
"Thank you for your faith in me," he said, smiling ruefully.
"You never know. Crazier things have happened."
"Not crazier than what did happen. See you later. And Penny, thank you."
"No problem. See you at 6.
He had 3 hours to wait until he saw her, and half an hour later, James scanned Marguerite's letters to him, and he sat at his desk all afternoon, reading them, as tears streamed down his cheeks. Knowing all he did now, it seemed a tragedy to him that Marguerite had been robbed of her child. Even more so for her than for his mother, who had no idea what she'd missed. Marguerite knew exactly what she'd lost and mourned it all her life. The firm Penny worked at had an impressive name and a big reputation, and she had a handsome office. She had been a full partner for several years, and when Philip walked into her office, she got up to hug him. She was a good-looking redhead with a great figure and a husband who was crazy about her. She sat back at her desk after hugging him, and he took a seat across from her and told her the whole story. His mother's secret, illegitimate birth, her grandparents claiming her as their own, with a birth certificate that had been doctored and paid for and falsified at birth that her grandmother was her mother, their disappearing their oldest daughter and keeping Valerie from her, and then the coincidence of his doing the appraisal on Marguerite's intestate estate, his mother's guesswork, and the information the old nanny had provided her, which appeared to be accurate, but was unofficial. He told her about Marguerite's letters, too, which confirmed it all in depth and her own words.
"So what do we do now to establish my mother as her mother's rightful heir?"
Penny thought about it for a moment and jotted some notes on a pad, as she had done during his whole astonishing recital. But as an attorney, nothing surprised her anymore. She had heard far stranger stories, although Philip's was remarkable.
"First, we send someone to get a statement from the nanny. At 94, we don't want a dilly-dally. If she dies in her sleep tonight, the story and the corroboration dies with her. I'll try to get someone up there tomorrow. Do you think she'd be willing?"
"As I remember her, she's pretty chatty. Also, she wanted my mother to know the story. I don't know why she didn't tell her sooner, but at least she did now. If I hadn't done that appraisal, my mother would never have seen those photographs and would probably never have found out who her mother was or that our grandmother wasn't really her mother." The story was so amazing, it shocked them both.
"Fate moves in strange ways," Penny said, and firmly believed it. "My next suggestion may not be something your mother wants to do, but it will simplify the whole story. I want her to get a DNA test. We'll need an order to exhume her mother's body, my aunt and your grandmother, I guess," she said, considering it. "We have to get the court's approval for that, and I don't see why they would balk at it.
as long as we are willing to pay costs, which I assume we are. He nodded confirmation. And if it's a match, it's pretty straightforward. The court would then confirm your mother as the rightful heir, and what she does with the property after that is up to her. It takes 6 weeks to get the results of the DNA, and if it's a positive match, it's a done deal. What about your mother? Would she be a direct heir, too, as Marguerite's sister? Penny thought about it for a moment, and knew how unpredictable people were when estates were involved. But she thought she knew her mother better than that, and her financial circumstances. Penny's father had left her a very substantial fortune, and his parents had established a sizable trust for Penny. There was no need for the two women to fight over the money. She could certainly make a claim on the estate, Penny admitted. But I think we should leave that up to the sisters. Let them work it out and come to an agreement. My guess